Let us pray. Lift up our hearts, O God, and enlarge our minds that we may appreciate the truth which makes us free, the love which never disappears, and the hope which thou hast planted in our hearts. We remember in thy presence those who carry responsibility for difficult decisions in international affairs, and for those who are in peril at this hour, including graduates of this school. Enable us by thy grace and truth to improve our understanding of men and nations, and our ability to deal with the problems confronting thy people in a decisive age. Let thy blessing come abundantly upon this company of thy servants. Make us eager to hear and swift to obey thy word, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. We are happy to welcome you to the 1968 series of the Carver Barnes Memorial Lectures and to the seminars for pastors now related to this series of lectures. We think the primary test of the excellence of a school is discoverable in the life and work of its graduates. And we are delighted year by year to observe the love of learning in the alumni of this seminary who return to the campus for serious study. We are exceptionally fortunate to have as our speaker this year Dr. Martin E. Marty, Associate Professor of Church History at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago and Associate Editor of the Christian Century. Dr. Marty is a graduate of Concordia Seminary at St. Louis and the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. He earned the PhD degree at the University of Chicago in 1956. Dr. Marty, as we know, stands on the front line of thought and action in American Christianity and interprets what is taking place in church and society at a high level of personal integrity and professional competence. It is a privilege to welcome him to this campus and to present him to this audience. Dr. Marty.
Thank you, President Binkley. Friends, this week for the Carver Barnes Lecture, we will speak of the Christian uses of the future. I've been introduced as an historian, and the future is a very strange place for a historian to be. Historians, as you know, are people who have to wait until something happens before they have anything to talk about. They try to deal with a sense of logical propriety about the tenses, past, present. So how can we talk about the Christian uses of the future? What are we going to try to do with it this week? Henry Steele Commager, one of our foremost historians, recently collected a set of essays under the title The Search for a Usable Past, by which he tries to demonstrate how a society, in order to make any kind of planning for the future, has to retrieve a sense of the past or invent a past. Thus, the fathers of this nation in its early years did not have long centuries of tradition behind them. They had to invent and create very rapidly. We see the same kind of thing happening in our own society. For example, black power or black nationalism as movements are highly aware that they have to create a usable past from Africa, from the Afro-American past, and so on. For if you would move people, if you would create a vision, if you would instill and generate hope, you do this somehow in the context of the history that has shaped people, the search for a usable past. Just this week, a new book is coming out called Toward a New Past, which seems, again, like a strange concept, especially when we recall that here, too, the essays in the book were all written by younger American historians who are arguing with old ways of reading the past, dissenting historians who have a different vision of the society than those which historians have conventionally held. I am turning around Henry Steele Commager's title and suggesting that what is happening in many of these instances is that we are searching for a useful or a usable future. For we realize that the future is constantly changing the past. Our concepts of the future change our views of what has happened. The past doesn't lie there inert. It lies there for our retrieval. The historian is the one who is the custodian of the memory of a society, of a church, or whatever. A complex form like a society doesn't have a memory like each of you as persons do. But now and then, society stops to think. And the historian is the person who should be around when society stops to think, to say, this is a turn that we have tried before. This is a direction that we have taken and failed. This was a road that was good. But he doesn't do this only in the light of inert materials from the past. Thus, with the Christian past, never does the church in a generation use all of the things that has happened before. We use selective moments. When we needed again to learn the full humanity of Christ, we look back again at the Council of Chalcedon, where this was discussed. When we come back again to understanding the part man plays in salvation, we might retrieve and retrace the Pelagian controversy. When we want to understand something about the nature of grace, we revisit the 16th century controversies. We don't keep them all of the time in the forefront of our mind. We revisit them in the light of needs. What's more, the unfolding future, which means the present, constantly keeps changing the past. That seems like a strange concept, too. But suppose a Kentuckian had stepped out of that little cabin on February 12, 1809, and announced to his neighbors, if anybody would have cared at all, the author of the Emancipation Proclamation has just been born. It would have been an incomprehensible concept. It was true, but it was true only in the light of later events, and thus, too, in the early years of our Christian epoch, it would have made little sense to say, the Lord of the Americans has been born. But indeed, it was true. Or it became true when there were Americans to be Lord of. So the unfolding future is constantly changing the past. And in these four lectures, we're going to play with both of these directions. Today, and 2 days from now, I'll speak mainly of presence. And tomorrow, and 2 days from tomorrow, we'll speak mainly of some specific ways of envisioning the future. Today, I'm going to talk about the world that never came of age, with obvious reference to the most famous phrase of the theology of the last 20 years, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's comment that the Christian church will have to live and Jesus Christ will have to be followed in a world that is coming of age, or a world that has come of age, depending upon our translation. Now, many of you may not recognize that there's a problem in noticing that the world never came of age. Many of you may be dealing with people who were not relating to Bonhoeffer's problem, which I'll try to define and describe in a moment. And so I suppose my first task will be to see to it that we are all on the same ground, sharing the same problem. Otherwise, there's not much use to talking about the subject. When Gertrude Stein was on the point of death, her friends hovered around, and first word they heard from her was, "What is the answer? What is the answer?" And nothing came, and she revised it, and her last words were, "What is the question?" Reinhold Niebuhr says, "There's nothing more useless than an answer to an unasked question." So if I try to answer what I think happened to the theology that related to this unfolding secular world, it is important for us to see that we are talking about the same situation. My thesis is really very simple, that during the past score of years, Christian leaders, particularly in the realm of thought, but also in the realm of action, Protestant and Roman Catholic alike, the Christian leadership of the Western world, has devoted most of its energies to trying to relate the church, its program, and especially its pattern of thought, to a model of a world that didn't develop. We dealt with a largely mythical picture of the unfolding world, a rather closed and too simple model. We followed certain trend charts. We followed certain lines of predictability. And assuming that this is where the world is going, assuming that this is where man is going, have dealt with certain futures, and in the process have done the wrong thing for the right reason. We have tried to relate to the world, which is what Christians always ought to do, but we have related only to a part of the world and a part of its problem. And we have deprived Christian witness and Christian theology of many options, perhaps at the cost of gains to future humanity. So I shall be today engaging in some criticism of the past 20 years' venture in theology. It is a criticism, I must say, from within. I'm not today arguing against the people that I think of as the bad guys. I'm not devoting myself here to people whose arguments I find it easy to topple because I stand so far from them. This is self-criticism or internal criticism. It's an attempt to sense whether we are using appropriate models of human history as we try to talk the language of the divine. 20 years sounds like just a moment in the history of Christian thought and Christian life. But from another angle, I suppose it seems very audacious to try to lump main tendencies of our time with all of the change and all of the complexity into a single metaphor like the world come of age picture or the secular picture. Especially if you're involved, as I am, in charting weekly change in the church, or in the case of editing an annual volume called New Theology, where we notice a rather startling pace of change year by year, it seems audacious to step back and talk about these 20 years. But historians who sometimes speak in terms of whole epochs should now and then venture also and talk about this period of years. When I do engage in this criticism, I've implied already that some of it is said with regret. I wish the world had come of age in more ways than it did. I wish that a certain kind of secularization were developing on schedule, as it were, because I see that many of the counter tendencies are a retrogression in human history and present new problems for the faith. But I also believe that Christians should address the real world and not a world of their or their theologians' making. If I say it with regret because of all of the energies and time put into what may have been in part a wrong turn, I also say it with hope, for I believe that during these 20 years there have been some gains in theology. There have been some new modes of addressing the actual world, the real world, of so many people's perception. And with that in mind, then, you will detect, I'm sure, some moments of regret and hope. Now, my quick summary of what I see to have gone on during these years, and still going on, for today we don't want to kick dead horses or stop straw men. As far as I can tell, this would still be the main line of Protestant and Catholic theological energy in our time. Toward the end of World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, writing from the Nazi concentration camp, picked up certain themes in theology from his mentor, Karl Barth, and from a less well-known man who died last year, Friedrich Gogarten, and fused them with his own personal vision, trying to describe what was happening for the environment in which the whole church and all the world was going to live. In his summary, man was fundamentally changing. He was moving, as it were, beyond the gods, beyond the realm in which the divine mattered to him, the supernatural, the transcendent, the metaphysical, the mythical orders were all slipping away. People, as it were, live in mentally furnished apartments, and the people that Bonhoeffer saw no longer lived in the apartment that homo religiosus, the old style religious man, had done. For most of the ages of human history, atheism has not been a problem by any stretch of the imagination. Only once does the Bible even hint at something like atheism, and at that time it doesn't deal with anything like modern atheism. It deals with the atheism of the man who knows better there is a God, but is foolish enough to say there is no God, so he can act as he will. The world in which the Bible grew was a world full of divine, angelic, and demonic beings. And the environment of early Christians was cluttered and clustered with earth mothers and grand sibylles and mysteries and idols and alternative faiths. But Bonhoeffer envisioned man moving out of that world into what I would just simply call a worldly world. Man is no longer bugged, no longer hung up, if we can take some of the colloquialisms of our time, by the issues as to how he should relate to this divine order. He would be post-religious, post-superstitious. He would have moved beyond all this. And his word was, the world had become mündig. It was full of mündigkeit, which is a pun on the German word mouth, Mund, and it's the word that you use when someone is old enough to speak for himself. It was no longer under the tutelage of the gods. It was no longer carried around by the nose, led around by the nose. It was no longer tied to divine apron strings. Man is now autonomous, independent, a free being. This was the description that Bonhoeffer presented. This description, written in the concentration camp under a totalitarian regime, a regime that was using all kinds of quasi-religious symbols, has puzzled many people. How could Bonhoeffer have this envisionment of enfolding humanity? Well, on the one hand, he got it from his own inner life. He found that he himself could be loyal to Christ without all of the cluster of religiousnesses and pieties and metaphysics that his forefathers had held. He got it from his experiences and his reading in the universities of Europe, in his travels in Spain and the United States and elsewhere. But was this all it was to his vision? His best friend, the recipient of the letters in which the phrase appears, and now his monumental biographer, Eberhard Bethke, was in the Nation a couple of years ago, and some of our students asked him, how could Bonhoeffer have been so dumb to speak in those terms of the world having come of age? And Bethke says, do you think he was reporting? He was prophesying. No, the world had not come of age. For him, this was the vision of the future. For him, Hitler, who was still living, was already dead. Christ was the Lord of the powers. He had already triumphed. He was speaking a word of the future and applying it to the present. And that moment was, I suppose, the moment of insight for me as to how to interpret this movement in theology. Now, it moved very rapidly when these letters were translated. No one, I'm sure, should look at Bonhoeffer and say that the whole movement of modern theology is dependent upon him. The thought of Barth and Gogarten, for example, I've already alluded to. And even in the middle of the 19th century, an Anglican theologian like Frederick Denison Morris had spoken very much in terms like this. And there were moments in American theology that had suggested something about man's at-homeness in the world. The confinement of the secular order as being now the new open milieu for human freedom and Christian witness. In the United States, this thought was picked up undialectically. It didn't appear in the whole context of opposites that Bonhoeffer used. And through a very complex set of sources came to be a main line of theology in our time. I'll set all the proper nouns on the table at once so we know about whom we're speaking. Many of the people to whom I'm referring have a V-A-N in front of their name. That might be the easiest way to know about world come-of-age thought or secular theology. Paul van Buren, Cornelius van Poorsen, Arend van Leeuwen. I haven't quite figured out why all the Dutchmen found the world came of age before the rest of us did, but they did. In our society, by far the best known was Professor Harvey Cox and the Secular City. In his own way, but I think only in a half way, Bishop Robinson in Honest to God, the Roman Catholic theologian Robert Richards in his book Secularization Theology, and all the people writing books with the word secular in the title, Colin Williams' Faith in a Secular Age, Ronald Gregor Smith, Secular Christianity. So that by the mid-1960s, the word secular had become the obsessive issue in Christian thought. And to some people, like William Hamilton, carried to its final conclusion, the secular theology became radical theology or death of God theology. I once wrote a one-line review of Professor Hamilton's book in the form of a letter. Dear Bill, we Protestant theologians are all in the God-killing business. You simply overshot by one. If you'd like, I can give you some more one-line book reviews. My book review for Malcolm Boyd's book, Are You Running With Me, Jesus, is also one line long. Jesus replies, what, in these long robes? So, so we see here carried on to its fullness the Christian prophetic witness to the way the Lord of history topples the idols, clears the ground of the elemental spirits from which Christ is to have made us free, has us affirm that this world, the created order, is indeed the dominion of God, has us see that Christ is to be Lord of history. And so there was much talk of being where the action is, finding the Lord of history in the streets of the modern city, what my colleague Gibson Winter calls the new creation as metropolis. And it is this model of the world that I'm calling into question today, not because it is false, but because it is only an important half-truth. Yes, Bonhoeffer, Cox, Robinson, all of the van people in the vanguard, I guess I should say, are right. Something profound happened to the psyche of Western man in recent years. Perhaps in one sentence I could summarize it best by reference to a living philosopher, who, because he not long ago on television said something nice about our president, has become our nation's official philosopher, Eric Hoffer, who said that somewhere along the way in human history, God and the priests seemed to become superfluous, but the world kept going on anyhow. Hoffer is very much devoted to aphorism and succinct statement, and I think this says a lot. Somewhere along the line of history, God and the priests seem to become superfluous. Secular man cannot say God is dead. That's something that only Protestant theologians could assert. They had some secret knowledge that others may not have had. Secular man is too agnostic to know what's going on the other side of a screen of a transcendent order. He will say much more diffidently, God seemed to become superfluous. The processes of the laboratory, the legislature, the classroom, human inquiry, daily life seemed to go on the same way whether a man believed in God or not. The world kept going on anyway. And there's no question about it that not only our contemporaries, but we in our bones sense profound changes in the way we perceive reality, including divine reality. But should Christian theology be content with this model? Is it an accurate model? For it assumes certain things. It assumes in a way that the world is one thing. The world is coming of age. Doesn't say Northwest Europe and Anglo-American people in highly industrialized, affluent technological societies, when they cluster in academic life, are coming of age. Though this is very much the model that some of the people used. Is the world that one kind of thing? It assumed further that the world is a thought-out, finished product, that the world is that self-conscious about itself. It assumed still further that the task of the Christian then is to take this nearly finished off world and relate to it. Add a gloss here and there. Say you're going a little too far in this direction, not far enough in this one. You still have a few more idols that Christ, the purger of the temple, can purge. You still have a few myths that have to be demythologized. You still have a few superstitions from which we can help make you free. But basically, you're in the right direction, and we're involved in a kind of a mopping up operation. And just as it said, the world is one thing, is a finished product, and we must relate to it. It seemed to go on to say the best way we can relate to it as Christians is to throw away as much as we can to be as mobilized as possible. Bishop Pike had planned to call his book Fewer Beliefs, More Belief, on the assumption that many of the beliefs of the Christian world were so related to that dying order of human perception that they could in no way be resuscitated, and we could only be free to understand and to serve if we would jettison, throw away. And the church should simply mobilize certain economical, theological resources to be at the side of a world that still had some need. This is what came to be called radical theology or new theology. Now I will play a dirty little game. Whenever you want to engage in the 20th century in criticizing someone's thought, you certainly don't say he departed too far from the tradition. You rather say he called himself radical, but he wasn't nearly radical enough. All of the reviews of the death of God theology went in that line. The problem with the death of God theologians, you wouldn't catch yourself saying, is that they denied the Christian tradition, but rather they weren't radical enough. That's the way you play this game. Now, having announced the rules of the game and put you in mind of the fact that I know that you know that I know what I'm doing, I'm going to do it and say I think this is the case. I think that the radical theology was not radical enough in the sense it did not get to the root of the human situation. And my main point this morning is to ask the question, are we using an accurate enough, a rich enough, a pluriformed and varied enough model of the world and the human future for us to be of service to people and faithful to Christian thought? Let me take the three tenses now and engage in a little criticism of this approach from that point of view. Past, present, and future. Past, first of all. Is it historically accurate to say that secular man has emerged, that the world has come of age? You will find some people. I, in an academy, a university, am surrounded by great numbers of people who would live under Eric Hoffer's picture. God and the priests are superfluous. There's no way in which one could easily change the subject and get them to see that there should be some reason to relate this all to the divine. In some senses, as Bonhoeffer well knew, and as we all know, this is part of what looks like a natural process in history. Separation of church and state, for example. Legal secularization is something which almost every American Protestant accepts. And yet, in a sense, it is indeed secularization. It is indeed saying that you don't have to covenant and compact a whole society around a certain metaphysical view. This is what was new about this first new nation. Our Constitution is metaphysically silent. It doesn't commit us to this. That's what's new. And we say this is a gain. modern medicine could not have developed without some kind of secularization. As long as people held superstitious and mythical views of the body, there couldn't be dissection, there couldn't be inquiry. You had to have a certain process of change in history before this could occur. But it's not the whole case or the whole story of what man is. It takes selective features of Northwest European and Anglo-American life. It takes selective features of technological, scientific, industrial, political, and academic development in the West, and then writes it on a huge screen and says, this is the whole of human history. The theology that has related so positively to secularization has added to that view of historical process one very important insight, and that is to recognize that the worldliness of the world is based on an impetus from the Bible. This was Friedrich Gogarten's main point, that what we in the West experience as secularization is something that we ought to be involved in. Maybe we should advance the pace of the world's secularization. Thus Paul Van Buren says, I, as an American Christian, am concerned that India isn't secular enough, fast enough. People still jump into sacred rivers and die. People still keep tens and hundreds of millions of sacred cows alive while children starve. And if I can demythologize their history and their religion, I can be an agent for them. And he would do this in the name of biblical impetus. Gogarten says that this kind of thing has happened, that the Bible's been picked up this way, as I read him, at least four times in history, by the prophets of the Old Testament, who de-divinized the political order. They upset the kings. It happens again in Jesus, who frees us from the elemental spirits. And since Gogarten is writing in Germany, it happens again in Luther, who picks up this. Luther could say, as Bonhoeffer enjoyed saying, that God might just possibly enjoy more the angry cry of the atheist than the pious prattle of the believer who was obsessed with his belief. Justification by faith, in a sense, is to move us past concern about our own condition. How am I doing, God? How are my brownie points? How are my merit badges? You're to be free of that for others. And Gogarten says that's a third stage. And the fourth, as I read him, is in Friedrich Gogarten, who once again picked up the motif. My problem with this view of history is, what is God doing in the meantime? What is he doing all the time when people are building these structures that are knocked over by prophets and Jesus and Luther and Gogarten? It overlooks too much. It overlooks, for one thing, the majority, the vast, vast majority of people in the world, who know almost nothing of the circumstances of life that I've described, industrialized, affluent, technological, scientific, industrial, political. It doesn't recognize that Eastern man may never secularize on our model. To do this against the background of Judeo and Christian history is much different than to do it on the background of something like Buddhist or Hindu history. Well, aren't they going to do this someday? The theologians who used the world coming of age motif assumed, yes, all men will sometime or other. I would say we have no reason to know that. It hasn't happened yet, and the trend is not in that direction. Societies can move over a hump of transition from one society to another, carrying with them a lot of glacial moraine of the old. And the Hindus may do it very well one way, and the Islamic world very well do it another way, and they may never borrow all of the features of our history. They may borrow our technology, but not necessarily with it all of the idea patterns that produced it. And so I'm arguing that it is historically inaccurate to say that the world has come of age or is coming of age on a single model. There are more models. The second takes us to the present. Is it accurate as far as our contemporary life is concerned? Again, we know very well the importance of the half-truth about secularization. Emil Durkheim and the sociologists who devoted themselves to this question noticed, getting back to Eric Hoffer's line, that as God and the priests seemed to become superfluous, it simply meant that one after another of the realms of life was set apart for a specialist. Thus, in olden times, people superstitiously read entrails of chickens to find out tomorrow's weather. Nowadays, we turn on the late-night weatherman who has all that radar and all that beeping and blurping and signals going and all of meteorological science, and we assume that he's at least 0.001% more accurate than the entrail reader of the past. We don't go to the witch doctor, we go to a physician who, if he's a modest physician, will say, we're a little bit up from witch doctoring. We are beginning to learn some of the mystery of the body. And in each case, another area is taken away, as it were, from God and the priests. Thus, if someone at our university's physics department would come to our divinity school for an answer to a problem in physics, we wouldn't give him an answer, we would give him a set of directions how to find the psychiatric clinics. Because he has a problem. He's looking for an answer that is inappropriate to our discipline. So life breaks down into these separate models. But when we do this, we have to ask ourselves, is this account for all that man is too? What definition of secularization do we use to show that the world has come of age? David Martin has written an essay called Towards Eliminating the Concept of Secularization from Sociology, in which he says, whenever you use the word like that, you very likely are carrying with you a lot of baggage, a lot of assumptions. So many people would say, world come of age means that man used to be otherworldly and now is this worldly. And David Martin asked the question that I would have far too good manners to raise. He is a Britisher and not an American, and he's not a Baptist. So he can say it, and I'll just quote it. That's what you always do when you quote something precarious and want to make a point that you don't have the courage to make yourself. He says, if you really want to say, is man secular, let me use a single phrase and tell me, is this man this worldly or otherworldly? And his phrase, which he says every Britisher would recognize, is Texas Baptist millionaire. Now, is a Texas Baptist millionaire this worldly or otherworldly? In the imagery of the whole world, there is no one around who is more materialist, more devoted to the question of oil depletion allowances and gold reserves and so on. He is given over wholly and utterly to the way this world is run. He is model secular man. But follow him into his church, says David Martin, and he will insist that he hear a gospel of pure otherworldliness. He wouldn't want his minister to meddle in politics, to discuss oil depletion allowances and gold reserves, or anything like that. Is he secular or not? And he says, as long as this man exists and I can produce him, then an ideological model of secularization doesn't mean much. And he goes on to show what I think is then very clear to show, that when we have an inevitabilist view of the human future, we are carrying to it a doctrine. Thus the Marxists definitely believe that the world is coming of age for the sake of the classless society or development. God is dead, said Karl Marx. Marx, in other words, is at that point not the historian or the analyst, he is the prophet. He's talking about the future. He's saying the day will come when all men will recognize that they've moved beyond this. Or another way to do it is to be a rationalist and say when people wise up, they will move beyond God. Or still another way is to be existentialist and say in a world of fundamental absurdity, man will understand this. In all of these instances, again, we find that people are not being mere reporters. They are reporting in the light of a vision that they would like to see prevail. And that leads me then to my final point today, which sets us up then for the week, the future. I am arguing then that the talk that has guided, formed the center of Protestant and Catholic theology during the past 20 years is essentially a futuristic philosophy of history. What is a philosophy of history in this sense? It is not ordinary history. The historian may use philosophy, he may analyze, he may try to clarify his concepts, but he isn't dealing with history in the substantive whole sense. He has to wait and see. He doesn't know the final outcome of history, and therefore he cannot tell the complete story of the past. And we just don't know the final outcome of history, what man will be. In the last word of the most famous, the last line of the most famous poem of the 20th century, William Butler Yeats' The Second Coming, he asks whether people would recognize, quote, "What rude beast slouches to Bethlehem to be born?" Do we really know that the man of the future will not envision new, maybe promising, maybe terrifying kinds of religious consciousness? Hitler, Stalin, obviously worked with quasi-religious symbols. They were not content with the old religions, but they demanded, in Tilly's terms, the ultimate concern of all the people in the society. They used ritual and myth where the Judeo-Christian tradition had to falter because of its root in Jewish thought. For Hitler, he could lug in all the old gods from Valhalla, but gods there had to be, and symbols there had to be. Our society, have we come of age? 3 million astrology magazines sold at each change of the zodiac. No metropolitan newspaper would think of going on the newsstand without telling you what's in the stars for you tomorrow. Late night television. Have you ever seen a celebrity who could get on or off without some sort of invocation and benediction, either to the gods or the stars? Consciousness of all kinds of elemental spirits and powers around them. Do we often see secular man in the legislature in a society where if someone would say, "I am an agnostic" or an "I am an atheist," he could not possibly be elected? At the beginning of Harvey Cox's book, The Secular City, he gives the definition of this world and secularization as being the world understanding itself without reference to religious or quasi-religious symbols or myths. I take that very literally and say to be merely secular then would be to carry that project out without giving much thought to it. To be utterly secular would be to say the minute somebody would introduce a religious or a quasi-religious symbol, it's no longer secular. By the end of the book, The Secular City, you find that symbols like Exodus Church, God's avant-garde, the Lordship of Christ, I would say highly religious symbols, have been evoked. And this is the case of all of the books of theology which use a certain model of the secular world and then find, by invoking a biblical perspective, they do have an intrusion that breaks that simple model. None of us, in other words, are quite content with the world come of age. We have been using a too closed and sterile and dull vision of what man is and can be. We've been too confident of trends for the future. Since World War II, two societies have turned industrial, technological, political at a pace faster than almost any other: Japan and Southern California. Transistor radios, aerospace research, and all the rest. Since World War II, Japan has 100 new religions, including Soka Gakkai, the fastest growing and among the most militant of all. It has seen the resuscitation of Buddhism, Shintoism. It saw for a time a reintrusion and strengthening of the Christian faith in its presence. And in our own society, what part of our 50 states has more reputation for more kinds of religions and nut religions than Southern California? And there simply aren't enough people going around in Japan and California to say half of the people are secular man and the other half are religious man. There's a great deal of overlapping. The same sets of people are living in this double kind of realm. Our task, I would argue, in Paul Ricoeur's terms, then, is to see what the modern world really is like. He said in an extremely important passage once, "The modern world lives under the double sign of a growing rationality and a growing absurdity." A growing rationality. We are able, as secular theology so wisely and well pointed out, to see domain after domain coming under the powers of man. Computerizing, programming, systems designing, and an increase of absurdity we see in the hands of the same men the use of this for the killing of others, for the removal of the options of the future for others, we see an increase of meaninglessness. And this happens very rapidly in our own time. January 4th, 1965, Professor Hamilton said, "We'll go down in history as a change in human epochs." T.S. Eliot died, the last of the tragic, gloomy, metaphysical Christians. And our great president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, in his inaugural address, envisioned the Great Society, which all of us white Anglo-Saxon Protestants with academic tenure were now recognizing as the Kingdom of God. And so Professor Hamilton wrote an essay called The New Optimism from Prufrock, T.S. Eliot's figure, to Ringo, Ringo Starr of the Beatles, The New Optimism. He must have written this 5 minutes before Watts burned. For today, that optimism has disintegrated. That sense of man in control has disappeared. People worry about the survival of the society and of the world. Ringo Starr is no longer the new optimist, but is the new religious man trucking around with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the guru in India. The hippies have emerged as a sign of discontent about the character of our spirit and our soul. They may not be orthodox, but they are anything but non-religious. An increasing rationality and an increasing absurdity. And in the middle of that world, we will this week be looking for our usable futures. Paul Ricoeur says, in that world, the Christian is one who persists because he detects a surplus of sense over nonsense and becomes a prophet of meaning. Not easily, because God remains hidden. Not easily, because the Lordship of Christ is perceived under the form of a suffering servant on a cross. Not easily, but actually, for he sees the power not only of the crucified one, the utter absurdity of injustice seeming to prevail, but of the resurrected one, where a supreme and higher kind of reason seems to prevail. Increasing rationality, increasing absurdity, both present in the world now. I cannot predict the future. I have not said this is what man will always be. I have said, if we want to serve people, to understand them, we should not narrow the range of our human models, but we should project into the future some of the tendencies we see in our own time and see man to be as he was, and perhaps as he shall be, in Nietzsche's terms, an indeterminate being, a broken unity. He's not yet established. He is multivalented. We don't know the end of the human story, but we don't only wait and see. We want to take a part in fashioning it in the name of the crucified and the resurrected one. Thank you.
Be with us, O God, in our going forth and in our coming in, and keep us mindful of what we have heard this day as we participate in the search for a coherent interpretation of life informed by the mind of Christ.